Hi, I'm Moji Alawodeyau from the Feminist Buzzkills Live Pod, the only podcast that helps you navigate the news in this post-pro anti-abortion hellscape. Each week, with co-host Liz Winstead, we dissect all the news from that sketchy intersection of abortion and misogyny with providers and activists working on the ground. The cherry on top is we have amazing comedy guests who help us laugh through the rage. Feminist Buzzkills Live drops Fridays wherever you pod. Listen and subscribe, because when BS is popping, we pop off.
Hello, and welcome to Care Talk, where we talk about how healthcare works or doesn't work in America and answer your health insurance and healthcare questions. Please text or call in your questions at 202-838-6837, and we'll answer them in future episodes. Be sure to subscribe to my channel or podcast wherever you get your podcasts to get the next show. And now it's my pleasure to introduce Bobby Kogan, the Senior Director of Federal Budget Policy at Center for American Progress. And he also has personally gone through the budget process in Congress a few times and will share some of those stories with us. Welcome, Bobby.
Thanks so much for having me on.
So tell us, the House just passed a budget blueprint, but not actually a budget. So what happened?
That's right. This is the first step in a long process. And what matters about this process is that it's a way to avoid the Senate filibuster. So in the Senate, in most places in the world, if you have a majority, you can just do what you want. But in the United States, in the Senate, you need 60% of members to agree, not just a slim majority, except if you're following this specific process. So this is the first step of keying up the process. The House voted to do its budget resolution, but you know, that's just a fancy way of saying they've begun the first step of getting to do this reconciliation bill, which again is just a way so that with the slim majority that Republicans have, if they all stick together, they can pass their bill.
And when we're talking about the budget bill, that this is all for next year's budget, right? This is not this year's budget.
The U.S. is a weird, most of the world, they say, okay, this is what we're doing. And then every year they say, this is what we're doing. The U.S. is a weird system where a significant portion of our spending is an autopilot. And then every year we fight about a third of it just for that year. The other like two thirds just keeps going. This is a fight on how to permanently change that kind of permanent two thirds. So it would probably begin next year, but it doesn't, you know, that would remain to be seen based on how they write it. This isn't like, this year we funded the government or we shut down. This is a whole separate process. It's all about, in this case, it's primarily about how do they want to change Medicaid, which is a permanent program? How do they want to change SNAP, which is our primary food assistance? And that's a permanent or a semi-permanent program. And then how do they want to change student loans? That's kind of the big stuff that they are doing. And then also, what do they want to do with the Trump tax law?
And so the House and the Senate both passed bills, but they aren't budget bills. They're more like instructions on how to write the budget.
Yeah, so that's exactly right. It's a silly process, but this step is they agree, the chambers agree internally amongst themselves, we want to do something that vaguely looks like this. And so what they will do is they will instruct the various committees inside of Congress to achieve some deficit change. Basically, when legislation is written in Congress, because everyone can't be an expert in everything, we kind of subdivide and say, hey, you, why don't you folks become experts in this area? And if we want to work on bills, you folks write this. You folks can be experts over there. And so they instruct kind of the places that have jurisdiction over various parts of our laws to achieve some deficit change. And in this case, kind of the big things that, you know, what's relevant for healthcare is that the House instructed the Energy and Commerce Committee to find at least $880 billion worth of deficit reduction. And inside of that is basically all of our healthcare. And so they told the committee that oversees the healthcare, you know, healthcare programs to do giant cuts. And that sets up the process where, as long as they play by the rules and everything, they will eventually write the bills, and then eventually they will be filibuster proof. Eventually that goes to the floor and it either becomes law or it doesn't become law because it gets voted down, as happened in 2017 when they tried to repeal most of the ACA.
And so the House passed one thing, the Senate passed another, and they are very different bills. So what happens next?
Yeah. So next they need to come to an agreement on the framework. We're not even at the, like, are we writing the individual bills yet? They have to agree on the framework. They have to agree on the instructions to the committees. So right now the House said, hey, energy and commerce, you have to find at least $880 billion worth of savings, which would necessitate huge Medicaid cuts. Or technically, it would necessitate Medicaid or Medicare cuts, but I think we probably will take them at their word that they're not cutting Medicare. And so if they're not cutting Medicare, then it necessitates enormous Medicaid cuts. So that is the House's plan. In the Senate, they have different committees, but the relevant committee in this case is the Finance Committee. And they just said, hey, Finance, find some savings. But if you look at what they said, they were planning something smaller. They were only, for the Senate, their initial plan was to go after, Biden had a rule to make it so that long-term care facilities had to have an adequate number of nurses or whatever. And so they were just going to peel that back for some savings. So they are going to have to come to some agreement. I think for a long time, folks were imagining that the House's path was not going to happen. But then President Trump started using a lot of his political capital amongst Congress to really push them towards the House version. He ended up putting on Truth Social, posting, let's do the House's approach. And so now we're going to end up, we'll have to see exactly where we end up, but it'll be much closer to the House's version. The Senate was planning to do this kind of across multiple bills. And in the first bill, they weren't really going after Medicaid very much, as I say, except for narrowly on this long-term care issue. Over in the House side, they were planning to eviscerate Medicaid, you know, cut it by 12% on average and maybe growing depending on how they were doing it. And so the next step is for them to even agree how much generally they want to cut. And then if they can do that, then they begin writing the bills.
So what happens if the House and the Senate don't agree in the next few weeks or months about how much they want to cut?
Well, if they never agree, then we can pretend this whole, you know, this whole show never happened. It's dead. It's not going anywhere. They are working under the specific kind of path they're working. They have until September 30th to get the whole process done. And so I would say from here, if they were working at breakneck speed, they could do it. And they'd already agreed on all the politics and everything. They didn't have to have any more stumbles and everything. They could do the whole thing in a month or two, which if you try to rewind from September, August, July, you know, it's to say they probably need to have agreed to a framework by around July 1st. But you could have stumbles along the way. When they tried to repeal the ACA back in 2017, I was working at the Senate Budget Committee at the time, and they had this step of the process done by early January. Their initial plan was that they were going to be done by January 20th, by Trump's first day in office. So they had done this stage of the process by the first week that they had gaveled in. So it kind of depends. In this case, they have set a goal for themselves to give themselves a month. But that's really just to force action. As I say, they have until September 30th to get this whole process done. And if they fail, they could, you know, they just have to restart from ground one, and that would give them till September 30th of 2026 to try again. So really there's no end until they decide definitively that they've given up or they've done it. That's what happened with the ACA. Like, they could have tried again with the ACA in 2018. When they failed in 2017, they could have tried again in 2018, but they had decided that they had given up. And then they lost the House, and then it was over. So this, I would say in reality, this thing is live until at least the midterms.
Okay, unless there is clearly not the votes in Congress to take away healthcare from tens of millions of people, like what happened in 2017, where there were not the votes, and that's why they gave up and didn't try again in 2018.
That's right. Yeah, they as soon as it became clear that this was done, you know, and their decision at that point to pivot to tax cuts was kind of a recognition they were not doing this. And they didn't, even though they theoretically had the votes to try anything the next year, they didn't do another budget blueprint at all in their subsequent year. So I think a lot of folks are rightly seeing this as this is their attempt. If they succeed, they succeed. And if they don't, they don't.
And can you talk a little bit about why they want to cut nearly $1 trillion out of healthcare? What's the driving motivation behind all of these cuts?
I don't want to say something that's going to get me in trouble. I think there's a fundamental disagreement on morality. They responded last time by saying, oh, well, no one's going to be harmed. But you can't seriously tell me that if you take away $880 billion worth of assistance, that it's going to have no effect on real people, right? Like, it obviously affects people. And so they think that the government should do less and provide less. And that is a normative view, and tax less, right? Like, this is a bill that would simultaneously cut taxes disproportionately for the rich while cutting healthcare for, like, you know, for tens of millions of people. It depends how they do it. Over 70 million people are on Medicaid. I think something like half of births go through Medicaid. A lot of elderly folks are on Medicaid, and their view of the world is that the government should tax less and do less. And I think folks can have a real debate about what the government should look like, but I think most of us agree that people who are really struggling and really in need should get help. There are a lot of studies that show, particularly for children, that Medicaid is a really smart investment in the future. The Congressional Budget Office, nonpartisan budget and economic team for Congress, estimates that even if you don't pay for it, giving kids health insurance pays for half of itself, just due to, like, future success. You're more likely to graduate from high school, from college. You're more likely to hold down a job, et cetera, just from kind of making sure that you're healthier as you were growing up. And if you do pay for it, it if you end up 100% paying for it, it then redounds to itself to, you know, double pay for it, you know, to kind of end up twice as much. So I think they just think that the government shouldn't be involved here. They think that it's okay to have the government do less. Now, the way they will spin it, they will say, we're just going after waste, fraud, and abuse. But that's not true based on the policies they've outlined. The person who wrote this budget plan, Jody Arrington, released a one-pager in January. And he said, here's my wish list of where I'd like to get this from. And what you can see for the Medicaid cuts are, like, just doing less. It is giving, Medicaid is run through the states. And so his proposals are simply to give less money to the states, either to no longer keep up with need or to just give the states less money to run Medicaid. And what that means is either is lots of people kicked off of Medicaid, or it means a lot less covered under Medicaid, which is already a pretty meager program. So they just think that it shouldn't be doing what it's doing. And I think that we will have a big fight about that. And I hope that I hope that my side wins here, because the livelihoods of, you know, of tens of millions of Americans are at stake.
And I think your point is really important, that this is about ideology, that some elected officials truly believe that tax cuts for the rich are more important than healthcare for millions of Americans that need it. And if you disagree, then you should make sure that your elected officials know your opinion and they work for you, and they should be hearing from you what you want them to do or not do. So this is what Congress is going to be working on for the next few months until they pass something or give up. As you were mentioning, the deadline, at least for this year, is September.
End of September, yeah. It goes in the fiscal year, which confusingly does not match the calendar year. So it goes to the end of September.
So this is going, and this, I think, can you explain, this is not the same thing as the government shutdown that is imminent in the next few days that could happen. Like that's another budget fight, but it's a different budget fight.
Yeah, that's right. That one, remember I said, hey, there's kind of 2/3 that always goes on. There's 1/3 that we fight about every year. The government potential shutdown is about that 1/3 where we kind of renegotiate it every year. How much are we going to give NASA this year? How much is EPA going to get this year? How much are the National Institutes of Health? How much is NIH going to get this year? That's something we fight about every year. We don't fight about Medicaid every year. Medicaid is a permanent law. And so it only gets revisited if we decide to change it. We don't fight about SNAP every year, right? We revisit it every 5 years, but it, you know, other than that, it's not up every year. So the thing that is going on right now where we might shut down on the 15th, completely unrelated. This is Republicans are debating amongst themselves whether they want to do a permanent change to Medicaid. And I would just say, you know, back in 2017, they were only a couple votes short permanently destroying Medicaid. They wanted, right now, Medicaid grows with need. They wanted to switch it to have a growth formula, which would have made it so it fell further and further behind need over time. And so the long-term effect would have been eventually states just have to start disenrolling people, changing their, you know, their state laws and their Medicaid laws to cover fewer people. So that's kind of what's at stake here is how, like, what do we think Medicaid should be doing? And that's what they're fighting about, not how much should we give NASA, which again is also a really important fight, but just a separate fight.
Well, thank you very much for joining us, Bobby, and explaining the budget reconciliation process. And how can people keep following you for more insights as we continue to have budget headlines for the next few months?
Sure. Well, I am primarily now on Blue Sky. So you could follow me at BBKOGAN, BBKOGAN, at Blue Sky. You can also just email me, bkogan@americanprogress.org, and I'll do my best to try to be helpful. And yeah, I would just encourage folks to stay involved. And exactly as you said, I would encourage folks one way or the other, no matter how you have an opinion, I really do encourage you to reach out to your elected officials. Last time the ACA was saved because people attended town halls. So if you have an opinion, there is nothing more important than talking directly to your member or senator.
Thank you, Bobby. And now we're going to turn to our viewer questions, but let's start by talking about what's happened to our healthcare from the administration this week. So welcome, Rachel Bandley from the Center for Health and Democracy. Tell us what the administration is doing that will affect your healthcare.
Thanks so much for having me. And I wanted to highlight a really important change that came from the Trump administration recently. And they have announced that there will be large cuts to funding for Affordable Care Act navigators. Now, these are people who are specially trained to help you find and enroll in health insurance plans that will work for you, not just ACA plans, but they also help people enrolling in Medicaid and CHIP, which is the Children's Health Insurance Program. So they have announced that they're going to cut this funding by 90% for next year. So last year, these navigators were funded with $98 million. That will be dropping to $10 million, which will make it a lot harder for people to understand the complex health insurance enrollment process and to get the care that they need.
Thank you, Rachel. And next, welcome Louise Norris from healthinsurance.org to talk about what else the administration has been doing that affects your healthcare.
Thanks for having me, Laura. So one other important thing that just came out at the very end of February, HHS basically announced a change in how they're going to handle the rulemaking process. Rulemaking is how agencies like HHS set all sorts of rules and guidelines that don't have to go through Congress. So the Affordable Care Act, for example, left all sorts of things up to the discretion of HHS. And so they go through this rulemaking process to make those rules. And since 1946, there has been a law on the books that basically requires a public notice and comment period where when they're going to do a new rule, they have to propose it publicly and then give the public a window of time to comment on it. Then they have to consider those comments before they finalize the rule. Initially, there were exemptions for certain types of rulemaking, but in 1971, HHS drafted a waiver where they basically said, we're not going to take these exemptions. We're just going to use the public comment notice and comment period for all, pretty much all rulemaking. So after 54 years of that being the way things work, HHS announced at the end of February that they are no longer going to do that, which means for some rules, it can't apply to Medicare because that has its own statutory requirements for a public comment period when they're going to make a new rule. But certain other types of rulemaking could now go much faster and not let stakeholders and the public weigh in. So it's just, we don't know yet whether we assume this will be challenged in court, but we don't know what the outcome of that will be or exactly what rules might be subject to this. But it is just a way that the under the Trump administration, HHS could potentially speed up the process of changing some rules that are currently on the books.
Thank you, Louise. And our first question is from Laura in Virginia, who is me. I get my insurance through the Affordable Care Act in the Virginia marketplace. So I was getting ready to do my taxes for last year. I looked at the form that I got in the mail from the marketplace, which tracks how much I pay for my health insurance. And the numbers on the tax form were wrong. So the year-end total is wrong. And I'm wondering, you are not a tax professional, but is this a problem if your tax information about your health insurance is wrong? And if it's a problem, how would somebody get it fixed?
This is a problem. There's two issues at play here. If you are self-employed, then the self-employed health insurance deduction, you can only deduct the amount that you actually pay yourself after premium subsidies are accounted for, and you don't know the actual number that of what that is until you've reconciled your premium subsidies on your tax return, because the amount that got paid to you, you know, on your behalf throughout the year might not end up being the actual amount of subsidy that you get. So there is some circular math there, because the more your premium subsidy is, the, you know, that changes what your modified adjusted gross income is in terms of your, and then the less that you can deduct on your self-employed health insurance deduction. So it is circular, and the IRS has a process for working that out, but you do need accurate numbers in order to calculate it. And so if the marketplace has given you an incorrect Form 1095A and they've confirmed that it's incorrect, you can ask them to send you a corrected one, and they do have to send you a corrected one. And you can wait to file your taxes until you have that correct form, because to get it right, to reconcile your subsidy amount and then to get your self-employed health insurance deduction amount, you do need accurate numbers on that 1095A.
Thank you, Louise. Our next question came in via text. This person wants to know, what can I do to make sure Congress doesn't pass Medicaid cuts? I have a congressperson and two senators that already opposed the cuts, so they're not the problem. So, Rachel, what can somebody do if their elected officials already don't support Medicaid cuts? What can they still do?
This is a great question, and my first piece of advice would be still contact your members of Congress, because we don't just want people who oppose the cuts to pledge to vote against them. We need people who are loudly and vocally talking about the effects that cutting Medicaid will have on people who rely on that for their health care. So have your members of Congress talk about it every day, hold press conferences. Anytime they're asked something by a reporter or they're in a hearing, talk about Medicaid cuts, how they're opposed to it, and the detrimental effect that it will have. The other piece of advice I have is to talk to your friends and family, especially in other areas, because Medicaid has a lot of different names in different states. So many folks who are on Medicaid may be impacted by Medicaid cuts, but unaware. For example, in New Jersey, Medicaid is actually called NJ Family Care. In Tennessee, it's 10 Care. And in Texas, it's STAR. So there may be people who are on Medicaid, but there are these individual names. And so they're likely opposed to it as well because they rely on this program. So we need to make sure that people fully understand just how broad a program Medicaid is.
Thank you, Rachel. And just like how some people may not be aware that the Affordable Care Act and Obamacare is the same thing, I think it's important, like you mentioned, that people are aware that Medicaid goes under many different names in different states. And our next question came in via text. This person wants to know, my question is on the budget bill and Medicaid for myself in Virginia, where we have a trigger law. I have Medicaid through the expansion because I was denied disability. I'm so afraid to lose it, so I want to know when this bill will be up for a vote. Will Medicaid end immediately for me? Local elected officials are trying to add an amendment in Virginia to the trigger law, but I don't know if it will happen in time. Louise?
Complicated question, and it does go back to a lot of what Bobby was talking about earlier about the lengthy and complicated process that's going on in Congress right now. As he explained, all that's happened so far is like sort of setting the process in motion. We have a long way to go on getting actual legislation that would actually make changes to health policy. So we don't know yet what those changes might entail if and when they make it that far. But just for some background on this particular issue, Medicaid expansion, which is part of the Affordable Care Act, has been adopted by 40 states and DC. The federal government pays 90% of the cost of covering the people who are eligible under Medicaid expansion. So that's a lot more than the rest of the Medicaid population. The rest of the Medicaid population, it's roughly 50-50, but it varies from one state to another. Whereas with the Medicaid expansion population, states only pay 10% of the cost. So there are several states, including Virginia, where when they implemented Medicaid expansion, they put a trigger law as part of their law that basically said if federal funding for Medicaid expansion ever drops below 90%, we're done. We will cut off the program and end it. Virginia, there was an amendment that was being considered where they were going to basically soften that a bit and say that if federal funding drops, then the lawmakers would basically get together and figure out what to do. But that did not end up being part of their regular, they didn't finalize that in their regular session. They could still call a special session, and we don't know what's going to happen at the federal level. But if Medicaid expansion, if a state has a trigger law, and if Congress does ultimately eventually decide to reduce federal Medicaid expansion funding below 90%, then in those states with the trigger laws, Medicaid expansion would end in some cases immediately, in some cases very soon. People then with income of at least the poverty level would be able to transition to the marketplace and have very significant subsidies, both premium subsidies and cost sharing reductions. But unfortunately, people with income below the poverty level would in a lot of cases end up uninsured unless they qualified for Medicaid through a different pathway, maybe because they're the parent of a minor child, or unless they could qualify for an employer's plan. So it is a significant concern, but there's a lot of unknowns between here and when Congress gets this figured out.
And this goes back to the Medicaid gap, where in the states that never expanded Medicaid, people that are below the poverty line can't get Medicaid and can't get Affordable Care Act insurance either, right?
Gap in 9 of the 10 states that haven't expanded Medicaid, because you can't get a marketplace subsidy if your income is below the poverty level in almost all cases. And if you don't qualify, the reason for that is because those folks were supposed to qualify for Medicaid under the ACA. But because some states have refused to expand Medicaid, those people don't qualify for Medicaid. They also don't qualify for marketplace subsidies, which means if they wanted to get a marketplace plan, they'd have to pay full price, which is not realistic if you're earning less than the poverty level. So if this were to happen and these trigger laws were to kick in and basically end Medicaid expansion, in some of these states, the number of people in the coverage gap would increase significantly, because all of a sudden these people who have been covered under Medicaid expansion would suddenly no longer be eligible. So this is another one to contact your lawmakers, contact your members of Congress, and explain to them how important it is that that you keep healthcare. You know, tell them how hard you're working. Tell them that you have a job. But your job doesn't offer health benefits. Let them know that this is real people that they're affecting if they cut these healthcare programs.
Thank you, Louise, because they work from you and they need to hear from you because you are their boss, even if they don't always act like it. So thank you for joining us today. Please text or call in your questions at 202-838-6837. Join us next week for more on healthcare in America and get your questions answered. Be sure to subscribe to my channel or podcast wherever you get your podcasts. And this is Care Talk.
Our democracy is hanging by a thread, but we know it's not about just winning and losing each battle. It's about persistence and building resilience.
That's why we're launching the Practivist Pod, the practice of activism made practical.
If you're looking for ways to get engaged or just for ways to stay sane, we want to help you navigate what comes next.
It's an exciting collaboration with political dynamo Jess Craven, author of the Chop Wood, Carry Water newsletter,
and grassroots activist Steve Pearson, host of the How We Win podcast.
Every week on the Practivist Pod, we're going to have important conversations with changemakers, give you practical ways to make an impact, have some fun, and inspire hope.
This is more than a podcast. It's a place for our community to grow our practice of advocacy for justice, equity, and progress.
Action is the best antidote for anxiety. So subscribe to the Practivist Pod today.